Hi, and welcome to Tea and Strumpets, a Regency romance review. I'm Zoe.
And I'm Kelsey.
And today we're going to get straight into it because while Kelsey has nice, cool weather at her house, I have very, very, very hot weather at my house.
And so Poor Zoe.
I had to turn off my fan and I had to close my window and it's going to get very hot in this room very quickly. So the book that we are talking about today is A Duke, the Lady, and a Baby by Vanessa Riley.
Yes, and since Vanessa Riley is a new author for us, we thought we'd give you some facts about her. So, Vanessa Riley worked as an engineer before allowing her passion for historical romance to shine. A Regency era, early 1800s, and Jane Austen enthusiast, she brings the flavor of diverse peoples to her stories. Since she was 17, Vanessa has won awards for her writing and is currently working on two series. She lives in Atlanta with her military man hubby and precocious child. You can catch her writing from the comfort of her southern porch with a cup of Earl Grey tea.
Oh, that sounds so nice.
I mean, Which is all I want in life is a big southern wraparound porch. And it's funny because I talk to John all the time and I'm like, well, whatever house you have to have, it has to have a porch. Like, I just,
I require that in California.
I require it, Zoe.
Maybe a patio, a back patio you'll get, but it's hard.
I mean, I'll settle for one of those. But
we also have some history facts. There were some cool things in this book that I hadn't learned yet. And so, what I wanted to start off by talking about were the West Indies and Demerara. And I'm really hoping I'm pronouncing that right. Demerara, D-E-M-E-R-A-R-A. It is a country that no longer exists. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a second. But I am going to be completely honest here and admit that my geography knowledge is absolute shite. And whenever I've heard about the West Indies, I never knew that they were a subregion of North America. So I thought I would share that with everyone in case you were like me and somehow missed that in history / geography class. So,
well, you know, in the U.S., we rarely take geography classes, so just saying.
It's so sad. So the West Indies is a subregion of North America surrounded by the North Atlantic Ocean and the Caribbean Sea that includes 13 island countries and 18 dependent territories on three major archipelagos. And the subregion includes all the islands in or bordering on the Caribbean Sea, plus the Bahamas and the Turks and Caicos Islands, which are in the North Atlantic Ocean. And so then our heroine today comes from Demerara, which is a historical region in the Guyanas on the north coast of South America, which is now part of the country of Guyana. It was a Dutch colony until 1815 and a county of British Guyana from 1838 to 1966. And the name Demerara comes from a variant of the Arawak word for imminary or Dumaruni, which means river of the letterwood. And Demerara sugar is also named because originally it came from the sugar cane fields in the colony of Demerara. So you can still find Demerara sugar today. Huh. So learned a couple new things. Got my geography better. I read somewhere else too that, like, you know, it was the West Indies versus the East Indies. You know, India was the East Indies, and then these were the West Indies. And I don't know why that never, like, clicked in my head, but hey, I love it when a book teaches me something.
Yeah, there you go.
And something else that I learned in this book was all about pap milk. So we have a nursing mother in this book, and being the one feeding her child is really, really important to our heroine. And so it's an important part in the story, although I didn't like highlight it too much in the synopsis, but you'd get a lot more out of that if you read the book. But because she is separated from her son in the beginning, they try to supplement her son until they can get a wet nurse with what is called pap milk. And I'd never heard about this before. And I just find the history of breastfeeding in general, like, super fascinating. And
it is very fascinating.
You know, when we moved away from breastfeeding, you know, even in the 1950s, all the propaganda from the formula companies that really, mm-hmm. you, so it's like, I mean, it, but it really started in the 1800s that with the upper classes moving away from breastfeeding their own children. So,
yeah.
And even before then. But let's talk about pap milk. So pap or panada was the food most commonly fed, even to newborn babies who required alternative feedings, from a pap boat or a spoon. These vessels were made in most materials like pewter, porcelain, and earthenware. And pap itself was a flour mixture or bread cooked with water, with the occasional additions of wine or beer and sweeteners. Milk was sometimes added to the pap or used on its own in, like, bottle-ish things. However, animal milks were regarded with some caution because it was believed that the baby imbibed aspects of the animals, or indeed the wet nurse's, temperament and character with the milk. So, for example, goats were considered frisky, and red-headed wet nurses possessed undesirable moral characteristics.
Man, the poor redheads have such a bad rap, and it's just because they're so unique.
They've got the best hair.
They do.
Pap was a dangerous food because it was, as we can all guess, nutritionally inadequate, and it was often prepared with unclean ingredients. The cleanliness of milk and water supplies was, you know, uncertain back then. So, moreover, pap was kept warm for long periods of time in a ceramic food warmer in conditions that are ideal for the growth of bacteria. And the pap boat itself was a receptacle similar to a gravy boat with a spout and a handle. Sometimes it didn't have a handle. Sometimes it was just like a little vessel that you'd hold in your hand. And it became common to add flour to the milk or water to produce a more solid food. And this became known as pap, which could be fed to the infant from the spoon or the pap boat. And anyhow, I've got some cool pictures, which I'm going to put on our website or link to the pictures and the information that we got about this. So if you read this book, hopefully you appreciate these history facts about pap boats.
Yeah, I think this is excellent. And you know what? A pap boat looks exactly like it was described in the book.
Yay. Very cool. So we do have some tropes today.
Yes, we do. So today our main tropes are interracial romance, the line of succession, and love after loss.
And our main characters are Patience Jordan and Busick Strathmore, the Duke of Repington.
That's a great name.
It was quite a name.
It's a name. But it's not one of those, like, super long names. It's just a bunch of, like, you know, normal names. Busick Strathmore. I mean, if you don't have a title after that, then why did you get named that?
I'm sure he has more names hidden in there, or maybe I just missed them. There is a marriage at some point. There might have been more names added in there that I didn't. Okay, you're shaking your head now. All right, it's a strong, strapping name. So let's learn about these characters, shall we?
Yes. Our story begins differently than any of our others, for we are seeing the scene through first person, through the eyes of our heroine, Patience Jordan. She is on a perilous yet essential mission. She has disguised herself as a white footman and has snuck back into her own home to breastfeed her son, Lionel. After the death of her husband's uncle, Markham, had been a terrible tyrant. Already prejudiced against Patience due to the color of her skin and blaming her for her husband's suicide, he had her and her son locked in the nursery until she had become terrified and had panicked. When she finally escaped the room, Markham had restrained her and sent her to Bedlam, but maintained guardianship of her son.
Unbeknownst to him, though, Patience had been released, and she now risked recapture to care for her infant boy. Slowly and quietly, she made her way up to the nursery for a feeding, because she knew that no one could better care for and feed an infant than his mother. And she sees right away that she's correct. The boy has a rash and is stinky, and gobbles hungrily when she offers him her breast.
But while he isn't in perfect shape, He isn't in a dire way yet, and Patience knows that tonight isn't the night for a jailbreak. She has to prepare more before she will be ready to rescue Lionel. Luckily, she has people to help her, and if she can trust them a little longer, she knows she'll have her son back one day. After his feeding, she hears voices in the hallway and has to hide outside on the window ledge and scurry down the side of the building. Quote, hand over hand, toehold after toehold, I lowered myself until one boot hit the ground and then the other. I drew my arms about me and made sure my heart was still inside my ribs. But it wasn't. It was in a dingy crib, three stories up.
But our heroine has made it out safely, and tonight she can sleep knowing that her son has a full belly. Except that she doesn't quite get away unseen, for as she's leaving the property, a carriage and cavalry come running through the gate. She stops herself once seen, knowing that she's dressed as a footman, so perhaps her disguise will hold. She is called to help a man out of the carriage, a duke who is apparently at her old home to effectively storm the castle, for it turns out that he is actually the legal guardian of Lionel Jordan, and Markham is not.
Helping this man out of the carriage is a big job, as he requires a lot of help and isn't quite steady on his feet. She struggles valiantly to help him into the house, as he uses her as a crutch until an actual crutch can be brought to him. But this man who requires assistance and a crutch is not old nor overweight. Instead, he's a prime specimen of manhood and obviously a soldier, so she assumes he's been injured at some point. He is introduced as the Duke of Reppington, and Patience is confused, for hadn't that been her husband's grandfather? But as we readers know, dukes die and are eventually replaced with younger, handsomer, and eminently more single dukes in this book.
Once they're inside, things happen in a flurry. Reppington's men have assembled all the staff and are letting them go. He also lets Patience go, as she's disguised as a footman whom she tells him is named LaCroix, as he cannot risk anyone loyal to Markham staying in his staff here any longer, though LaCroix is welcome to reapply in the morning. He also tells LaCroix that he is in want of a wet nurse for his new charge. In case she happens to know any, she should refer them to him. And there the seed is planted for our heroine to find her way back into her own house. But for now, she leaves to fight another day.
Once she has left for the evening, we turn to Busick's point of view, which is written in third person. The book will switch back and forth for the duration. The Duke is pleased with the takeover. So far, it's gone according to schedule, and Markham's surrender is moments away. No one else quite understands why he would go to such lengths for a baby, but once he discovered his favorite cousin's son had been left to him, he knew he must care for him. They had had a falling out at one point in their lives, over a woman, and that had led to silence and for Colin Jordan to fall under Markham's spell. When Colin had killed himself, Busick had been wretched at the news. He would not fail Colin's son.
What he doesn't understand is what kind of mother would leave her son. He knows nothing of his cousin's wife, save for the fact that he cannot even get a whiff of where she's gone. He searched for Markham and the babe for 6 weeks and eventually found them, all the while with not a whisper about what had happened to his mother. And even more, what kind of a mother would abandon their child to Markham?
Patience, meanwhile, has returned to Lady Shrewsbury's house with her accomplice for the evening, Jemina. Lady Shrewsbury runs a society to help widows that she calls the Widow's Grace. She had rescued Jemina from Bedlam, and Jemina had refused to leave without Patience. And Lady Shrewsbury isn't happy with Patience's reckless behavior. Quote, I want to help you, but you continue to break the rules. Are your circumstances worse than any other widow here? Has your father's wealth made you think you're too good for our rules? I was never too good or special. I was different and discouraged and alone except for Jemina. Tears welled, but I couldn't swallow more grief. I was about to burst. I am awful and terrible, but I'm a mother. That doesn't make me better than anyone here, just more desperate.
The Countess tries to reason with Patience, explaining the dire circumstances of many of the other mother widows, finishing with, quote, I have sensible rules for your protection, Mrs. Jordan. You jeopardize the safety of the group when you break them. Rules. I'm dying from rules. I lowered my wet face into my gloves. The thin wool couldn't mop up my sorrow. Since stepping on these shores, I followed rules, did as everyone said. I was a good wife. My mama would have been proud of the home I kept. I wiped and wiped, ashy powder caked on my gloves, my sleeves. And you, a peer of this land, don't you like how well I've conformed? I've even practiced and practiced until most of my Demerarian accent has fled. But you see my reward, ma'am? My son still gets taken away. Rules don't help.
Patience realizes that she needs the widow's grace and Lady Shrewsbury's help, but that doesn't make her feel any less worried about Lionel and waiting. But she apologizes anyway, quote, "My repeated sorries garbled, and I wept upon the hem of the woman's garment. I don't know how many times my Lionel's been fed. His bottom is so red and pimpled from not being attended. I left him tonight to lay on soiled sheets. Soiled sheets! I don't want to disappoint you, Countess, but how can I be away to let him suffer?" Lady Shrewsbury bent to me, and I tensed for a slap. But the woman put her arms about me and drew me into the tightest embrace. Forgiveness. Not earned, not negotiated, not even spoken, but felt through and through. That's what Lady Shrewsbury's arms offered. I clung to her, baptized in her rose water and kindness.
And so the next day, the plan can begin. Lady Shrewsbury had had a plan all along. She'd had a spy in the house as a nanny for the baby who was reporting to her, and she'd been waiting for Repington to take over. Now that he had, as a friend of his, Lady Shrewsbury arrives at the manor house the next day with Patience and Jemima in tow to offer them as a wet nurse and a maid. When they do arrive, there are soldiers pitching tents in the hall who refuse to admit them because they're not on Repington's schedule. However, hearing the baby cry, Patience is reckless and runs to him, snatching him straight from the Duke's arms and latching him onto her breast before anyone can even protest. And while the Duke is not a fan of her antics, he does not know if he trusts her, he hires her on a trial basis as he can see that Lionel much prefers breast milk to the pap milk he's been trying to feed him. She introduces herself as LaCroix, the ambiguously either sister or wife of the other LaCroix that he'd met before. I can't remember either, and I feel so bad. But we're going to soldier forward, and she's a LaCroix. And Lady Shrewsbury tells him discreetly that Mrs. LaCroix had just lost a baby of her own, which is why she's available to be a wet nurse.
Patience and Jemima are relieved to be hired, not just to care for Lionel, but because a big part of Patience's plan requires her to be in the house so that she can retrieve her trust documents before she books passage back to Demerara. She also wants time to look around a bit, too, because she knows that Markham wouldn't have stayed in this house so long if he hadn't been looking for something as well. So now they have two reconnaissance missions to accomplish while they prove to the Duke their worth and do their best to be unsuspecting.
The Duke, meanwhile, also suspects Markham of something dastardly to do with the manor and is also interested in finding out what happened to Lionel's mother as well. So the group settles into life at the manor. The Duke is very regimented, to say the least, loves schedules, and expects Lionel to be so as well. He's created a schedule to help his new ward become exceptional, mapping out each quarter hour of his day to include things like crawling practice. And it's quite clear that the Duke does not understand three-month-old babies, but Patience begrudgingly accepts to follow the schedule.
I loved that. Crawling practice. 3 months
old.
Yeah, that's not what babies do, sir. The ladies transform the manor back to a house rather than a barracks by finding all the sheets and trunks in the basement and getting rooms set up for the men. Over time, they all come to love Patience's coconut bread, too. However, with such a schedule and so many men in the house, this doesn't afford the ladies many opportunities to search or retrieve Patience's documents. And in fact, they don't try it for a while they settle in.
In taking care of their ward, Busick and Patience grow closer together. Busick really does care for Lionel, even taking turns at night to soothe him. Though he knows nothing of babies, it's clear he does know a thing or two about nurturing and love. And of course, seeing the Duke treat her son with such tenderness does things to Patience's heart, and sharing the care of an infant and seeing him grow in moments together also helps the two of them grow closer.
Well, that makes sense, because apparently on a list of attractive qualities in partners, it's seeing your partner interact with a child.
And he does lots of great interactions.
He does.
He really does.
Little soldier.
I know, so cute.
We also learned that the Duke is an amputee. He has not publicized the news and has taken a very long time in private to recover. But the men he has brought with him to guard Lionel and train on the grounds are all also are all wounded recoveries who are looking for a purpose. He dreams of returning to the battlefield one day. He was a top tactician and knows he can still be used.
However, while our hero and heroine learn more about each other and share some tender moments over Lionel, there is not much trust between them. Repington believes that LaCroix could be a spy for Markham because she had too much knowledge of the house and a few other reasons as they crop up. But he reasons that for now, keeping her close is better than letting her go, for perhaps he can figure out why Markham wanted to be in the manor at all. And Patience doesn't quite trust Repington either. While he seems to genuinely care for Lionel, she learns he believes that Lionel's mother abandoned him, and he thinks her quite ill for doing so. How can she convince him that she's his mother and was falsely imprisoned for insanity? And does she trust him enough to tell him who she is? The answer is not yet.
Nope. As time passes, Patience and Jimena grow weary at the lack of progress. They wonder if perhaps doing some snooping in London would help their cause and rally to try to get the Duke to agree with them making a trip there. The Duke is hesitant to let Patience go to London alone. The reason he tells himself is he doesn't trust her and worries she'll be reporting to Markham. But deep down, he is becoming attached to her and doesn't want her out of his sight, both for her own protection and his own selfishness.
However, plans for a London trip are postponed when the chandelier in the Great Hall falls dramatically. Patience ends up shoving Repington out of the way to save him, earning her a nasty lump on the head and a few hours rest until consciousness. When she wakes up, she sees Repington trying to feed Lionel with a pap boat and sees her opening. Patience and Jimena make use of this time by sneaking downstairs and into the study, the one room they haven't yet been able to search because Repington is almost always in there or one of his lieutenants. Mm-hmm. They know that Patience's documents are there, and there's also been a mirror that's been jostled out of place a couple of times, so they decide to search behind it. And finally, they find something helpful.
It's a vault, and inside are a few things of note. Firstly, all of Patience's letters to her family and her father are there. Her heart sinks as she realizes that Colin had never sent them. But secondly, there is a journal, and within it, the final letter she had sent to Colin, the letter she had felt had been the cause of his suicide. She pockets the letter and turns her attention to the journal. It's an accounting record of some sort, with all debts canceled by a man named A. Sullivan. So now they have a new lead to investigate. Plus, the ladies are sure that this book is what Markham has been looking for.
However, the ladies are interrupted by Repington, who has caught them in the act. But, quote, "I wasn't sure if he was going to toss me and Jimena out, but I didn't care. I'd been through too much to be scared. I looked into those seeing eyes of Repington's and wasn't afraid. Too much was at stake."
Well, folks, this scene doesn't go how any of us thought it would. First, there is some sly sidestepping on Patience's part, which does seem to mostly dupe the Duke. Then he asks Jimena to leave, and some more serious flirting starts to happen. Then the Duke realizes that Patience is in love with him, which is why there is so much tension between them. She, of course, laughs this off and decides it's time she quits his employment. Quote, "Let me help you, my dear Duke of Repington. I'm not in love with you, and I quit my employment. I end this farce now." "No, don't." He reached for her hand, but she jumped from the desk. "I want you to stay. We can forget this, just like we forgot how we met and go on, like normal." At some point, the Duke did figure out that LaCroix had been the footman. She tottered a little and turned back to him. "Sorry, I must be swooning again. This love, it's too much. Yes, I must quit it. I must quit, for there is something else I must do."
And then she kisses him. Quote, "This moved too fast, felt too good, changed too many of my notions of dreams and decorum and desks." But she does stop the kiss from progressing too far, because she really has something that she must do. In front of him, she opens a secret compartment in the desk and retrieves her trust documents, and finally admits who she truly is. She also goes farther to admit that Markham had had her committed to Bedlam. She is taking a risk, but hoping that the Duke has had enough time to understand that she loves her son and is a good and devoted mother.
To summarize, Repington is not entirely convinced and also a little angry that she betrayed his trust by lying about her identity to him. Twice. However, the two continue to talk and speak more openly about Markham and the lady's thoughts as to why he's trying to get Lionel and get into the banner. While Repington isn't convinced, he is thoughtful about it.
The next day, Patience tells the Duke that she's off to London. She had to hide herself before, but now she's not his employee, so she wants to be honest with him about her whereabouts. She frets about leaving Lionel, but knows that he's safe with him, so she sets off on her adventure.
Of course, she has some parts of her plan for London that she hasn't divulged to Repington. Patience plans to check out two possible A. Sullivans that Lady Shrewsbury's lawyer nephew had found, and to do so in her male LaCroix disguise. What ensues is a bit of a crazy caper where Patience goes into a couple of gentlemen's clubs and does finally find A. Sullivan, who is a loan shark and realizes that Markham was trying to extort him to get out of debts he owed. But then Repington arrives with Lionel in a basket, for he had had Patience followed as he wasn't fully trusting of her, and proceeds to terrify while he plays a few rounds of hazard. Eventually, the two leave and share their info after a bit of a fight and head home as Repington's back gets worse and worse from the fall from the chandelier falling, the carriage ride, and a slip and fall that happened on a stop on their way home. There's also a kiss in the carriage because carriages.
But after that slip, once they're back in the carriage, the Duke actually asks Patience to marry him. Quote, "In fact, wear something fetching. I'll recover faster, chasing you in my thoughts." "A nice dress will help you heal?" "Yes, that and you agreeing to marry me. Now I know you fell and hit your head."
And while Patience doesn't believe it's a true proposal, the Duke has realized that Patience is actually one of the few people he trusts. Yes, they've been through a lot, but she's proven herself over and over to him, and he realizes that his attraction is big. They are basically raising a child together, and she's someone he wants by his side. When they arrive home, Repington's back is out, so he becomes bedridden for a while until it heals. This offers more opportunities for the two of them to grow closer and have some bedroom scenes with talking and touching and flirting. However, Patience is more wary about her feelings for the Duke. Quote, "I was afraid. Wasn't I pretending that we hadn't crossed a line in the carriage? That he hadn't hurt himself chasing after me? But mostly, that I hadn't turned down his proposal? What would make me commit to a marriage where I'd have to walk on eggshells? Lionel and I were meant for demerara and seashells."
But slowly, Patience learns to trust her heart and the Duke more. She lets him know about A. Sullivan and the journal. He spends time while in bed reviewing it, making a plan, while the two grow closer and share a few more kisses. Eventually, after a soothing in the middle of the night following one of Patience's nightmares, the Duke brings up his proposal again and tells her that he really meant it. They discuss it a bit more, with Patience finally saying, quote, "I don't look like what they want for you. The Duke's dark duchess, his difficult wife, his different wife. I'd be safer in Demerara. All of us would be." So he is asking her to think of being his wife, and she is asking him to think of moving together to Demerara.
But Repington has done some digging into Patience's family and has found out some terrible news. Her father has passed a few years back, and his plantation was sold, and he hadn't been able to track down her sisters. Patience is distraught knowing that she lost contact with them all because Colin didn't send her letters and because there is increased unrest there and her father's brothers believed in enslavement. So she worries her sisters could be enslaved.
So there really isn't a place for Patience to return to Demerara. And that's why Repington wants her to marry him, because if something happened to him as Lionel's guardian, if she were his wife, she'd get charge of his ward. Now, I'm not quite sure why this wasn't the case with her first husband, but perhaps duchesses have more power, or perhaps he could arrange it in his will as such.
I think it's the latter one.
I think so, too. It just seemed a little unclear to me.
Yeah. And so finally, Patience agrees, and they quickly marry at his bedside as he still can't get up with his back. But there's still a villain to vanquish. They devise a plan once Busick is almost back on his feet to make it look like the house isn't occupied and lure Markham to the house and trap him in his lies. Firstly, Repington has realized that the diary is actually in both Markham and Colin's hands. Their writing is very similar, but some of it is in Markham's, and he realizes that Markham had been manipulating Colin.
And like a good villain, once ensnared in the trap, Markham admits to more wrongdoing. He admits that actually, rather than killing himself when he received Patience's letter, Colin had been set to ruin the entire plot that he'd been going with Markham and return to Patience. So then we learn that Markham actually murdered Colin. It wasn't a suicide. And that he was, in fact, extorting Sullivan. And the book proved that to the tune of over £30,000. And he'd also drugged Patience to make her seem crazy and have her committed to Bedlam.
Yes. Actually, I think his initial plan was to have her, like,
kill herself,
quote unquote, commit suicide, like, yeah, by Colin did. But yeah, she's like, you just got crazy.
Yeah.
But that worked out too, because he could just commit her then. So after these revelations, there's a brief scuffle, which ends when Repington stabs Markham with his sword and he topples over the banister and then impales himself on a Greek statue on the floor below. And since there was plenty of soldier witnesses and it was a duke who did it, this is fairly easily explained away when the magistrate arrives.
But finally, our characters are safe from villainy and happy to have some closure. This causes them to confess I love yous and have encounter number one, which is not explicit, but is sweet. Quote, this mattress made for two held our love. We were one, the love between us burning brighter, growing slowly from embers to roaring flames. I was consumed. I was the woman Busick loved. I loved him, for he gave my life more beauty. This sharing of our spirits was pure. As pure as gold.
And then there's an epilogue. Our couple is living happily at Hamlin Hall, and the chandelier has been restored. Busick hadn't had to return to the front, but instead helped rehabilitate injured soldiers sent to him by Wellington and others sent to learn tactics from him. And they are very much in love with each other and their son, Lionel.
Oh, the end. We made it. So this book had some really interesting stuff that kind of didn't get into the synopsis because a lot of it was to do with how it was written. And I can't wait to discuss that. So shall we adjourn to the parlor?
We shall.
So today, I wanted to talk to you guys about Blush magazine, which I know we talk about Blush fairly frequently, but did you know that Blush got a bit of a makeover?
Ooh.
Yeah, so now is a great time to check out Blush. Again, Blush, it's not a subscription. It's a totally free digital magazine that takes readers beyond the pages of their favorite books to meet their favorite authors.
Blush is focused solely on the romance novel industry, interviewing authors, following trends, delving into tropes, and the many intricacies specific to the romance genre, and provides insightful, thought-provoking, and fun editorial content on a monthly basis.
So head on over to bit.ly/blushmagazine to check out the latest issue.
All right, and if you have a book recommendation for us, we would love to hear from you. If you have an inclusive author you love, or you just have a romance novel you just can't stop talking about, we want to hear about it and share it with everybody else here in the parlor. Let us know through our email, romancepod@gmail.com.
And if you like what you're hearing, why not share the show? You can tweet about us or share us on social media. So we're at Instagram and Twitter at T as in Tom, N as in Nancy Strumpets, Facebook and Pinterest /TNStrumpets, and YouTube by searching our name.
And if you really want to be in the know, sign up for our email notifications on our website. If you subscribe, you'll be the first to know what we're reading each month. Plus, you'll get all sorts of extras, including exclusive content from each of the authors who join us on the podcast. Our website is romancepod.com, and there you can find episodes, more information about us, and other resources. So take a look.
everyone. I'm Katie.
And I'm V.
And we are This Lesbian Ship is Intense.
We're a part of the Frolic Podcast Network. And in our podcast, we cover TV shows, movies, and really any other form of media with lesbian characters. We break down shows from a queer point of view. We gush over our favorite ships. And we critically analyze the impact of media on our community. Check us out on iTunes, Spotify, or SoundCloud.
All right, it's time to talk about a Duke, the Lady, and a Baby.
Yes.
Which is
Let's talk about it.
Not the easiest title that rolls off the tongue. I always wanted to say The Duke, a Lady, and a Baby, or A Duke, a Lady, and a Baby. I don't know why.
Yeah, I was thinking, I kept saying it was A Duke, a Lady, and a Baby.
Yeah, I was like, I really do wonder why that choice was made. I wonder if it was like it's, I don't know. Anyhow, I just thought that was interesting. But that's small beans compared to all the other stuff we get to talk about. So
yes.
So how was your experience with this? Because this book was pretty different from a lot of the historical – from any of the historical romances that I've ever read.
Yes.
For one specific reason, and it's the first person, third person.
Yes, absolutely. So most romance novels, as you all are probably aware, are done in third person. So you hear the person's name and the author tells you about their innermost thoughts, but you don't see through their eyes. Versus in this book – you saw through Patience's eyes, but then you got the third person discussion with Busick. So like his was more typical romance, but Patience was all first person. So personally for me, it took a while for me to kind of hit the rhythm with this book, mainly because like I was getting used to, I don't typically read first person books. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. I think just a lot of books aren't written in first person. And so
not in the genres that you and I both gravitate towards. Yeah.
No, because usually there's just a lot of characters and you want to be able to break from the main character. And so it's just easier to do that in a third person writing. Yeah. So it took me a while to get kind of into the rhythm of like switching between the two.
Yeah.
Although it was very easy then, because sometimes, you know, people have talked about with some romance novels how sometimes they get lost when it switches from like the lady to like whatever from the heroine to the hero, because sometimes the flow is just so flowy.
Yeah, it's one paragraph to another. There's not like a real break.
There's not like a very defined break versus this one, like you definitely knew who you were reading.
Yes. So I actually really loved that. That was one of my favorite things about this book. And I assumed when I opened it up and cracked page one and it was the word I was like, wait, what? I was not sure. But then literally by like the third paragraph, I was so enthralled. Like Patience, I found her parts to be extremely compelling. Mm-hmm. And having it written in first person as like a mother who's doing, you know, these kind of daring things to get back to her son was very, very compelling to me. And so I liked that because her background is different than most historical romance heroines that we heard. I felt like I was really hearing her voice, and I really liked that because I felt like I was really getting to know this character in a kind of a deeper way than I often get to know characters, and also because she is so different than me, I appreciated that because I felt like I was really learning who she was. I don't know. I really liked that.
But I can agree with that as well. I did feel like we had a really good understanding of who Patience was. Uh-huh. But then I guess that was also – I think that's probably why I found it jarring between the two shifts in perspective.
Yeah.
Simply because like I really felt I understood Patience's feelings. But then on the flip side, you just like – there was kind of like a disconnect to Busick.
So
like, I understood
I agree,
like his main parts of him. But
I agree, but I argue if perhaps it's not to do with the first person, third person, because I was fine with that because as a woman reading this book, and maybe if I was a man reading this book, I wouldn't feel the same. But as a woman reading this book, I usually identify with the female character more.
Yes.
So that makes sense to me. But so I didn't mind the switch to the hero being in third person because I was like, I wasn't sure how I would feel if it was first person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I just think that Patience's character was so strong and Busick's was not nearly as strong as hers in comparison. So I just felt like he didn't have the same depth that she had. He felt a bit more one note. And we can get into that when we really talk about the characters.
Yes.
So I think I would be interested if other books in this series are the same with first person. And I think it is because I read the did you read the snippet for the next book with Jamina?
No, I haven't. I haven't read that yet. No.
Oh, I was also – that was like a page turner. I was like, oh, my God. I've got to like find out because it was very like, you know, capers and kind of spies and that kind of stuff. Not spies, but they're trying to figure out things about their lives and make their lives better. And it's compelling and it's interesting. And I was very interested with her book. So I think that it can work. I just think that Busick fell a little flat for me. And we can talk more about him.
Yeah. We can talk more about that later. Yes. And then moving on to the plot of the book.
Yeah. So that's where I had a little bit of trouble with this one. I thought the plot was way overly complicated. I tried to simplify it for the synopsis because there are a lot of pieces of the plot that I didn't put in there because I wanted the synopsis to be a synopsis. And if I had really included all of the plot points, it would have just been twice as long at least.
Yes. Well, and I will say too, there's a lot of plot points that you've highlighted some in our notes and I agree with. Like there were a number of plot points that were never – like they were mentioned multiple times, but then they were never brought to a conclusion.
Yeah, and I think –
and in fact, they even admit at the end of the book
– they did.
– that some things were not brought to a conclusion. They're like, well, we never figured out this thing. And it's like, but why not?
Yeah, I wish that – and I don't know if that was just the choice to like, you know, try to make it more interesting and like have these clues and not as a reader know what's
throw
right.
ourselves – yeah, to just like – keep our mind busy so we didn't quite see it as super straightforward.
Yeah, but I felt like those things didn't add to the story. And I do wish that they had been out. And I wish that the plot with Sullivan and Markham, and then it turns out that her letters weren't sent to her family and she can't go. There's just like – there's so many things that happen in this plot that caused them to kind of like not trust each other. And I wish that it had just been simplified a little bit. If just a few of those plot points had been simplified, I think we could have had a little bit more time to focus on our couple. And I think that their relationship would have benefited from just a little bit more time together on the page when they weren't trying to solve a mystery. But we didn't have that in our tropes. We usually have that, like, solve a mystery together.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da. Yeah. So I think that the plot was just like just a touch more complicated than it needed to be because I found the beginning of this book and the ending of this book very compelling, but the middle of the book just got a little muddy for me.
So for me, I actually found – the beginning was slower for me, and I think it's just because, one, like I said, I had trouble with the back and forth, and so I had to kind of, like, wrap my mind around that for a second.
Yeah.
And then I actually found that once I kind of got about a quarter of the way into the book, I thought it really picked up, and I really, like – and then I was kind of in it. And yep, I was gotcha. Like – and I found it a page turner, and I felt it was really compelling. So for me, like, the first quarter was hard for me to get into. And, yeah, there was, like, a couple spots where I felt like it kind of slowed a little bit, but it wasn't – it didn't slow overly much. It was like – because it would only be like – I felt like it was a slow chapter. It wasn't a slow section. But I felt that there was always just like a lot of things going on. And the plot, I will say, was always moving forward. Like there was always some conflict to be continuously worked on and resolved. I mean like – and for a good portion of it, it's the fact that Patience is keeping her true identity secret from the Duke. And she's kind of like battling – the will I won't I, because initially she wanted to walk up to him the second, like the first morning after he, you know, after she was a footman and be like, hey, I'm the mom. Like, I need to be in there.
Yeah.
And then I loved she that was about convinced her. by Lady Shrewsbury that that wasn't the correct plan yet, simply because if he looked into her and seen that she was locked in Bedlam, his trust for her would dwindle. So I get the whole idea of, like, you have to slowly build the rapport so that even though you are lying initially, the lie can be forgiven because at that point he'll know you and trust you, and so he'll be willing to listen to, like, the reasons why.
I did love that scene where she does finally reveal herself, like, it does not.
Oh, I love it. It's so matter of fact. She's just like, I'm done with this.
Yeah. She's like, enough is enough. But also, like, that whole scene does not go the way that you think it's going to go.
No.
It's like, but when she does finally, when he quote unquote realizes that she's in love with him, and she's just like, okay, yeah, buddy, like, I'm super in love with you. Like, you know what, dude, we're adults, and obviously there's an attraction. I am not in love with you. And at some point he's like, is this hysteria? And she's like, oh yes, I'm overcome. You know, it's so great.
I love it too. I loved that scene too, simply because It was fun because you, like, saw him stumbling to try to keep up with it. And since it's from her point of view, she's just like, I walked over to get my documents. And he was like, well, you don't need those. Like, why do you need those papers? Like, if you needed employment papers, like, I keep them in, like, upstairs. And she's like, no, other papers, like, other ones. Yeah. And it just, like, it's so funny because, like, she didn't outright, like, just blurt it out. She just was like, I will show you who I am by finding these things in the secret compartment.
Yes. And, yeah, no, so he – I want to get to talking about them more in depth because I think they're really interesting. But there was just one little, like, misprint that really upset me. Did it upset you too when they referred to his horse as a Shire three times and then once referred to it as a Percheron and then referred to it as a Shire?
It didn't bother me too much, but then I was like – they're like, Shire, Shire. And I was like, okay, okay, okay. And then Percheron, and I was like, that's not right.
Also, neither of which, I mean, she said in the writing, Shires and Percherons are both breeds of draft horses. And I'm not so familiar with Shires I'm more familiar with Percherons. Percherons are massive. I wouldn't call a Percheron a war horse. A Percheron is like it's a pulling horse. It is going to pull the cart.
Yeah, it's a heavy muscled horse. I rode one for a while. He was fun.
Yeah, no, they're super fun. But I just mean, like, they're probably not going to have the stamina to be a war horse, you know,
no, and keep they up. They don't like cantering. They like trotting.
Plodding.
Yeah.
But anyhow, it's just like, why is it Shire and then Percheron?
I don't know.
They're not the same horse. Sorry, horse girl moment.
Only we would know that, Zoe. Only we would know that.
I know. But yeah, just I have to because I'm a horse girl. So let's get into our hero and heroine. I think let's talk first about Busick. So yes. I felt like Busick's character had two dimensions. He had schedule. Like, I like schedules. I do everything on the clock. And it was very much like, I have five. Okay, we've made it into the house. I wanted to be here at this time. And now it is this time. So we're adjusting the schedule by 5 minutes. You know, like, it was just like, okay, we get it.
It was intense, guys.
Yeah, this guy really likes schedules. The other thing was, like, mistrusting, you know, where he was just like, I don't know who to trust. And I was just like, but you're such a tactician. Like, why is this?
You need to be able to trust somebody, buddy.
Yeah. I don't know. So it felt weird. And I think, like, he was also supposedly a rake, but he really just didn't display very rakish behavior.
No.
He displayed very fatherly behavior. And so it didn't feel necessary to me. There was kind of this conflict at one point of, like, patients being like, your reputation precedes you. You know, like, you're a rake and I don't want to just be one of your women. And I was like, I don't even feel like we needed to have that conflict. You know what I mean?
No.
Like, if that just hadn't been a dimension of his character. Not that he hadn't been a rake. Not that he'd been celibate or anything. But just that I just didn't feel like he needed to have that because it didn't really fall, like, true.
Yeah. No, because it was meant to kind of be like his rakish past was going to cause conflicts, but it never really did cause a conflict. It was like, or if it did, it was like a 2 second, like, well, I don't want to be one of, like, you're all your other women. And he's like, what other women? Like,
yeah. So I just felt like he was a bit one note. And so in contrast, especially to Patience, who we're going to talk about next, I felt like he just was so much weaker.
Yes, and I think I will agree with that. But I also think that there was a lot of like hints where we could have gotten a lot more depth out of him.
Yeah.
Because it was hinted at with a lot of things. He had some like ongoing issues with his mother. You know, he had some like grandfather issues. He had some like invalid dad issues. Yeah. You know, he now had to go from being like a strapping rake who was a duke, who was a leader on the battlefield. And now he's like having to deal with like becoming an amputee. But he's like hiding it even from some of his closest friends. Like,
yeah,
it's all very interesting, but you didn't get a lot of that information. And I think part of why it fell so flat was because you got so much from Patience, because you saw so much through her perspective.
Yeah.
That you didn't really have quite the same from him. And it wasn't just that because it was a third person perspective, because you can get a lot of good information from a third person's perspective. But it just didn't get delved into, and you didn't hear those innermost thoughts the same way that you did Patience. And it really was a stark difference.
Oh, for sure. And I think you totally pointed it out, because all those things you said about him are so fascinating and make up such an interesting character. But then when you see him on the page, yes, you learn those things about him, but you don't see you don't get to really see how they affect him. Like there's moments and hints of it, but instead it kind of goes back to, I don't know if I trust her, and are we on schedule? Like that's what it just keeps reverting to.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, dang it. Because I agree with you. I think there's like a really interesting character in there that we just didn't get fully fleshed out.
Correct. I would agree with that. So what would you rate him?
So I'm going to rate him a little lower, because I just think he could have been so much more. And so I'm going to give him a 6.
Okay. Yeah. I think that's about where I am, because like, I do like him. I think he had a lot of potential to be a good character, like to be an excellent hero.
Yep.
But it just wasn't quite on the page in comparison, mainly to our heroine.
Yeah.
Who like was so multidimensional. Like, she was a mother. She was worried for her son. She also had to deal with the fact that, like, she really did love her husband, but she felt like he really was disappointed in her, and she felt like she never pleased him. And then he committed suicide, and she thought that she was the reason for it, because she'd sent a letter to him saying how, like, being brutally honest about how unhappy she was. And she's like, it must have pushed him over the edge, because I never heard from him after I sent the letter. And it turns out that Markham had just like killed him early, but didn't tell her until December.
Yeah, and then
I know,
wrote,
that was a
and
wild
then,
note.
Yeah, he had been dead so much longer, and then also he forged the note from Colin, the suicide note. It was just like, sad things. So I totally agree. Yeah, I think Patience was stellar. I think she was interesting. I mean, she had so much to contend with, you know, because she was brought back and she was taken to this strange land that she didn't know anything about. And she tried really, really hard to conform and to fit in, but also like wasn't even brought into society because she felt like Colin you know, was ashamed of her, had just kind of married her for her money. And so she has a lot to contend with, but she's a really strong woman. And I loved that about her, you know?
Yes.
Who, and obviously, like, fighting for your child, like, there's nothing better than that. Like, there's not a character trait that, like, rises above that, because it's just so heartwarming, like, you know? And those moments in the beginning when she's like, you know, talking to Lady Shrewsbury and also like explaining, like, I have to do this. I know that, you know, these other mothers are also in dire straits, but that doesn't mean that I can't not do the thing. Like, I am compelled to do so.
Agreed. And you even see her, you know, you saw her she's like, I'm not sure if I quite trust Lady Shrewsbury, but if I don't trust her, who can I trust? And like, I have to trust somebody, because otherwise I'm going to be all alone. And I've already been all alone, and I can't do that again. So.
And I loved what you said earlier, too, which was that, like, you know, Patience wanted to tell the truth. She really wanted to, but there were moments where I never felt like she should have, like, oh, I wish she'd done it there, because there really were moments where you're like, I don't know if he's going to trust her yet. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. And so I think she was smart not to reveal herself until she did.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. I really do. So, yeah. And what would you rate Patience?
I think she was really great. I think her one flaw was at the end, she kind of finally like acquiesced to being the Duke's wife a little bit quickly. I felt like, you know, finding out that her father was dead and then immediately being like, all right, well, I guess if I marry this guy, it just seemed like a little abrupt to me. Mm-hmm. And I felt bad because she'd spent this whole book, you know, wanting to go home to Demerara, and then that dream had to change in the blink of an eye. And I didn't feel like her connection with the Duke at that point in time was that strong. It was definitely more a marriage of convenience, and he said that to her.
Yeah.
But I was just like, oh, she kind of capitulated like really easily. And I don't think it was the wrong decision. I think she made the right decision, but it was just a little fast. So like for that reason, I'm going to give her an 8. I really loved reading her. I thought she jumped off the page. I want to read more characters like her. I want to read 15 more characters like her. I really liked her.
I will agree with your rating. And I will agree that I also would love to see more characters like her.
Yeah. And I like I said, I just really liked seeing it in first person. I actually – like I'm still – because, you know, I know you had a little bit of a hard time switching back and forth. So – and like I said, I wasn't sure how I was going to feel when I first started reading it. But I recently read a contemporary romance novel that – was for book club, and so I like tried really hard to keep reading it, but man, I just hated it. And it was written in present tense, not past tense, like present tense, like Alex thinks yada yada yada, and I was just like, I can't handle this. This is so bad. I hate it so much. Okay, but then I hit page 75 and holy crap, that book was so good once I got into it that I was able to forgive the terrible present tenseness, and I will now recommend this book to anyone who hasn't read it. It's many people have read it. It's not like I just discovered it. It's Red, White, and Royal Blue by Casey McQuiston, I think, or Quiston. I'm not sure. I don't have the book in front of me. And yeah, it's a fabulous book. So I think it's interesting when a book can kind of like, you know, have a thing that you don't like, and yet you can still end up liking the book. You know, I think that that's a mark of a good book. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't sure if I would like the switch, especially because I had just read Red, White, and Royal Blue, and I'd kind of been like, whew, that was like a little bit hard for me to get through because it wasn't my preferred style of reading. But yeah, I ended up really liking that. So I know that was a bit of a diversion back to earlier conversation, but I had forgotten I wanted to say that. So now I've said it.
Well, that's okay. You're allowed.
So let's move on to our favorite quote. Do you have a favorite quote for us today?
Yes, I do. All right. So here we go. So this is – she's talking with Lady Shrewsbury about coming up with the plan, and she's like, I just want my son back. And it's kind of a continuation of one of the quotes you had in the scene where she's like asking for forgiveness and getting that without question, which I loved that line that you threw in there. That was also a good one. Aww. So Patience says, how do I regain my son? We need proof of Markham's scheme. With her sherry eyes softening, the Countess clasped my hand. To put it bluntly, no one is going to believe you were his victim, not without proof. The prejudice against you being foreign, a mulatto, a blackamoor, a woman, a widow, are insurmountable. If it's found out that you're gallivanting in men's clothes and breaking into homes, you'll be sent back to Bedlam.
Ah.
And I just think it just perfectly encapsulated, like, Patience's problem at the beginning of the book, because like there was just everything was working against her, everything.
Yeah.
And there was this evil man, evil, truly evil, awful man, and she had zero power because of all the world conspired against her.
Yeah. And yet she rose above and championed at the end of the day. And I'm so glad she did. So a lot of my favorite quotes I included in here, there were some, like, I liked the eggshells versus seashells moment. Mm-hmm. I thought that was good. I also really liked the, you know, my heart, to check to see if my heart was still in my chest. It wasn't. It was at a dingy mm-hmm. crib three stories up. Like, I think those are both, like, really great quotes. But so I included a lot of my favorites, but I have another one here, which is, "Each time I picked up my son, felt his skin next to mine, I became a revolutionary. For him, his life, his liberty, I charged forward."
Oh, I love it.
I know. I
think it's such a perfect encapsulation of, like, the quote I gave you against, like, talking about all the things against her. And then yes. She's just like, and then she's like, but I'm the revolutionary he needs to make his life better. So I will keep moving.
Well, as we should keep moving too, because man, it's getting hot in this room.
Oh, poor Zoe, poor Zoe. Okay, keep it moving.
Oh my God. No, I would love, you know, it's hard because I just want to chat all day about this book, but I'm quite warm. So, steaminess rating and encounter. So we had one encounter. It was not explicit, as I pretty much read the entire encounter. Mm-hmm. I would say, though, actually, that my cup of tea was a little cold in this one.
It was a bit of a cold cup of tea.
Yeah.
It was still a good tea, but just it was a
tasty.
Little. But when you expect hot tea and it's cold, it's just like,
Yeah. So I wish that they'd had a little bit more chemistry. And I think, like,
yes.
I think I already explained that. I think if they'd had just a slightly bit, couple of things taken out of the plot and a little bit more of development between them, there was plenty of time between them. If you read this book, like, you'll see that. But mm-hmm. I just felt like we could have taken some out here and put some in there and maybe just had like a little bit more mm-hmm. spark for them. So that's how I felt about that. Like you said, still tasty. Mm-hmm. All right. So, feminist recap.
I would say it was pretty feminist.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about breastfeeding. So
yeah. First I mean, like, of all, that's very feminist. Actively talking about breastfeeding. Hell yeah, it's feminist.
Yes.
Women, talk about your bodies.
Yes.
It's important.
Yes.
This has also become a new passion of mine. And I think it's very important. And I won't go into details. Yeah. Anywho.
I will also try not to go into details. But I will say that I recently learned that only 25% of U.S. women breastfeed their child for the first 6 months. And many, many more women are perfectly capable of breastfeeding their children. And we're so lucky to live in a world where if you cannot breastfeed, we have good options that can keep our babies healthy mm-hmm. and vibrant and, you know, and help them thrive, you know. And, mm-hmm. and just because you can breastfeed doesn't mean it's the right thing for you and your child. So I'm not trying to say that, but 25% to me seems like an extremely low number.
That does sound like a very low number.
Especially when you also, like, look again at the history of breastfeeding and even and just why our culture has told us that breastfeeding isn't a thing that we should do. It's just fascinating. Mm-hmm. And maybe we'll do a bonus episode one day where Zoe rants on breastfeeding. but yeah, it's fascinating. There are some weird reasons that we look at breastfeeding the way that we do, kind of as a stigma sort of thing mm-hmm. rather than just a natural process. So
yeah.
Also, I've never breastfed, so don't, you know, I don't expect to, or I'm not pretending that I know anything about it. But also, I do know how difficult and emotional and traumatizing it can be for mothers mm-hmm. Because it is not just as easy as necessarily putting the baby to your breast and having it latch on. So with all of that stated, I think we should get to our final book rating.
We're just going to say one more thing about our feminist recap, because also, like, a big point of the plot was, like, Lady Shrewsbury and her widow's grace.
Where yes.
This, like,
oh, my God.
She was
you're
a
so
woman
right.
who had been wronged, and her mission in life was then to help other women. And she literally, like, she just found Jemina. Like, Jemina didn't, like, write to her. Like, mm-hmm. it kind of, like, came on her radar that there was a widow in Bedlam. And Jemina was in Bedlam because she had amnesia. So she, like, just didn't remember things. So they stuck her in this insane asylum. because that's going to help her with her memory. And so, like, Lady Shrewsbury kind of, like, you know, stepped in. And then, like, Jimena's like, no, this girl's got to come with me. And she's like, well, she's a widow, so she fits the profile. She can come too.
Well, and intersectional feminism, right? Because Patience and Jimena are Black, and they don't receive any different treatment from Lady Shrewsbury at all. So I'm pretty sure that Jimena is Black. It's never explicitly stated, but they do find out something about her past. They do. Maybe that's in the snippet of the next book. They find out that she had been on a shipwreck, and it looks like she did have a husband who did not make it off the shipwreck. So where they were coming from was the West Indies, I believe. I can't remember all the details, but regardless, maybe I got that wrong. And if I did, apologies. If you guys read it differently than me, let me know. But yeah, totally right. And that's what the series is going to be about. I think it's about these women that are the widow's grace and finding their second chances. So, or third, I don't know.
But that's okay. It's excellent. I really want to know about Lady Gantry. You didn't even hear about Lord Gantry, like, but he's searching for his wife, and his wife is also set from Demerara, so, like.
Yeah. And his daughter, he's got daughters. And
he's got daughters, yeah.
I know we're going to find her in one of these books, so I'm interested. So, final book rating.
I'm going to give this book, like a 7.5. Yes, because, you know, talking about it more, there were so many really strong things in this book. And even with my, like, and the reality is at the end of the day, like, I found it a page turner. It took me a while to get into it, but I did find it a page turner. We talked about it. I wish the Duke had been just a little bit more, like, substantial as a hero. But I thought Patience was awesome. And I thought that, like, yes, there were plot things that plot holes. They're not even plot holes. It was just, like, plot excesses. Can we say plot excesses?
Let's say it.
So there's plot excesses, but, you know, I thought that, you know, it made a compelling story, and I am definitely, like, ready to pick up book two. So I think that that warrants a 7.5.
I'm gonna agree with you. We've been very agreeing today on all of our ratings. Yeah, what's happening? But I am gonna agree, because I think there's a lot to love in this book. And it's interesting because you and I loved really different things about it. Like, I again thought the beginning and the end were so compelling. I just wish the plot had been simpler, you know, because I think that the plot got in the way of these awesome characters sometimes.
Yes.
But regardless, I really want to recommend this book to people to read. Like, I want people to pick up this book. There's a lot more in there that we didn't talk about. And there's a lot that you would get as a reader from this book, especially Patience. Like, she's a great character, and I really want to read more characters like hers and hear more stories like hers in historical romance. And so, like, I really want to recommend this book, and I want more books like this to get bought and published.
I think you couldn't have said it better. So what are we reading next time?
Oh my gosh. Next time we are back to familiar territory.
Oh, excellent.
We are going to be headed back to Penny Royal Green to read It Happened One Midnight, which is the, what, eighth, ninth book in Penny Royal Green?
Getting up there. It's been a while, but I think we're getting up there.
So it is Penny Royal Green number 8. So we are trucking along in our series of 11, and I'm excited for that. And this is the Redmond clan. We're going back to the Redmonds. This is Jonathan Redmond's book. I'm excited for that. It's nice to revisit some old favorites.
I know. We've been doing a lot of new books, a lot of new authors, and, you know, and I think it's just nice to just have a little comfort. I mean, like, not saying I haven't enjoyed all these new authors or any of this. I'm just saying it's just like, oh, let's go home again.
Yes. So thank you all again for listening, and join us next time as we read It Happened One Midnight.
And may all your ever afters end happily.
Tea and
and Strumpets is part of the Frolic Podcast Network. Find more podcasts you'll love at frolic.media/podcasts.
Forgiveness. Not earned, not negotiated, not even spoken, but felt through and through. That's what Lady Shrewsbury's arms offered. I clung to her, baptized in her rose water and kindness.
Side note, every time I read that, I just think Hamilton, like, forgiveness, can you imagine? Like, I can't not. I just, I'm still on the Hamilton high after watching it on Disney Plus.
Okay, I watched the first half of it yesterday, but then everybody else fell asleep, and I just was like, we'll watch the second half tomorrow, guys.
I am offended that they fell asleep. Like, offended.
I know, right? But that's why I was like, well, we'll just turn it off and watch it tomorrow because
I know all this music.
Yeah, this is not acceptable.
Hamilton behavior. Right. Hold on. It happened one not night, not the 1934 film. Midnight. Okay. Da, 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 da. What number are you, mon frere? Gonna get there somewhere.
Have you started – wasn't that in, like, the last book we read where they were – yes. Well, it was in did you start – so I don't know what it is. Ever since we read Nine Rules to Break when romancing a rake, I've been wanting to say mon frère to everybody. And then I'm like, no one will know what I'm saying. So I'm just like, my friend, and I keep using it. But it's just like – I just, like, took it and I was like, I like this phrase, mon frère. So, like, I say mon frère in my head all the time. So with you just saying it, I was like – yeah, did you pick this up also from the book?
I didn't pick it up from the book. I've just always kind of said it. I don't know. Every now and then. I don't say it that much out loud, but no. I say it probably to animals more often than I say to people.
Well, so to be fair, I work with horses. I talk to animals all day. So I'm just like – or my cat when he's just being a cat.
Yeah, good old kitty.